Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I kind of don't know how to come in, actually.
Well, I actually have this one.
Okay, do it.
Speaking of genocide... We have brought in an expert to talk about a really, really disturbing subject that did not deserve the laugh that I just gave it. We couldn't figure out how to get into this story, so here we go. Chris, could you explain who you are and what the is going on?
Well, first of all, you're listening to Angry. You're listening to Angry Planet. I'm Matthew Galt, who does things at Vice. For now, Jason Fields is with me, the opinion editor at Newsweek. And we are joined by Christopher Atwood. Mr. Atwood, could you please tell the lovely people who you are and what you do?
Sure. So thank you. My name is Christopher. I'm a specialist on Eastern Europe. Particularly, my focus is kind of on, or has kind of evolved over the past year or so into looking into the history of colonial violence in Eastern Europe, particularly Russian colonial violence. And how that is manifesting itself in the current invasion of Ukraine. And so last year in May, a team of about, it was like a small team put together a report. I was part of that team on Russia's violations of the genocide, just a couple of months into the war. And we got a bunch, we got like 50 plus international scholars, international lawyers, genocide experts, Eastern European experts, to sign on and basically say Russia's in violation of the Genocide Convention. And there's a serious risk of genocide happening in Ukraine. And this year, just last month, in July, we published an updated version of that report, which concludes that Russia is committing genocide in Ukraine, and that, if basically there's a legal obligation to do everything in any given state's power to prevent genocide.
Can you explain what genocide is? I think that people don't really know the definition. It's very, very precise.
And and this report is within that legal definition within the international community, right?
Yes. So the report, the updated version of the report is basically the core group of people who worked on last year's report, which last year the principal author was a guy named Yonah Diamond, who's an international human rights lawyer, and then two principal advisors were Professor John Packer, who is the head of the University of Ottawa's international law department, and then Aaron Rosenberg, who is a visiting scholar at the University of Cincinnati's College of Law, and who's also an international lawyer, right? So these are like very serious international lawyers who kind of spearheaded the thing. My role in both reports was as a regional specialist to make sure that we get all of the appropriate nuance. And then this year we brought in the principal author this year is a professor, Christina Hook, who is an assistant professor of conflict management at Kennesaw State University. Her background is in genocide studies and in anthropology. So the updated report kind of takes a wider breadth to try to explain how this is genocide, why this is genocide. And yes, so we are in this report, we are operating within the that concrete international understanding of what genocide is. It's a very concrete defined thing by the Genocide Convention, although It should be noted that you don't have to have signed the Genocide Convention for the Genocide Convention to be applicable. At this point, so many countries have signed the convention, and our understanding of genocide globally is such that everybody, like, regardless of whether your country signs on or whatever you do, like, this definition is absolute. But basically, genocide is committing one of several acts with the main goal being to intentionally destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. The in part thing is also really, really, really important. You do not have to, one, you don't have to destroy the entire group, and two, you don't have to intend to destroy the entire group. You just need to destroy a significant enough part of the group in order for the group's continued existence to kind of come into question. Now, I should say that, like, the in part of the definition is something that is debated by international lawyers, and I am not an international lawyer, so definitely take, like, my interpretation with a slight grain of salt. But that is kind of the way that we operated when we were working on the report, is that in part just means a significant part of the group. And so then it's also important to define the five crimes of genocide, because the structure of the new report that we put out basically outlines how Russia is attempting. Basically, Russia is using this definition of genocide as like a guidebook on what to do in Ukraine. So the five crimes are killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting conditions of life that will bring about the physical destruction of the group, imposing measures to prevent births within the group, and then forcefully transferring children from one group to the other group. And the last one is, in my opinion, and in the opinion of a lot of people, probably like the strongest case that genocide as such is being committed in Ukraine.
You make it sound as if literally Russian leadership looked at this definition and said, like, oh, this is what we need to do.
You know, to me, when you look at the totality of what Russia is doing in Ukraine, it becomes very hard to, like, interpret this another way. It just the way that Russia operates, the way, like, because working on this report, right, we did this report entirely with open source materials. So we didn't take any interviews that were not published anywhere else. We don't have any, like, secret information from or private information from, like, the Ukrainian government or from any other organization. We've drawn on public reports, which means that I am somebody who has read a lot of UN reports and a lot of different humanitarian organization reports on how Russia operates when they occupy an area. And when you read some of these reports, the way that Russia handles the occupation is absolutely brutal. And it really does feel like they're kind of they get set up, and in the first several days of the occupation, they start to figure out who they're going to target for destruction in that locality, and how they're going to target them. Like, it really comes off like that. The biggest red flag is the way that everybody remembers, or people who followed very closely the lead up to the full-scale invasion remembers, the U.S. made a big deal about how Russia was keeping lists of Ukrainians of who to target for destruction before the full-scale invasion started. Those lists, by all accounts, are very real. I think the AP did a really great report on who's on those lists. But what is less known is that there are multiple lists. Russia keeps multiple lists of people, and one of their lists isn't compiled until they've actually occupied a town. So whenever they occupy a town, they do sweeps of residential areas. They knock on doors. They find out who lives where, who does what, who is responsible for what, you know, sectors of, like, you know, intellectual society, who are the thought leaders in the town, and those people end up on lists. They weren't on lists before the army occupied that area. They start compiling these lists, and as we kind of point out in our report, like this All of this goes back to the way that Russia talks about Ukrainians and the way that Russia portrays Ukrainians as effectively deserving of destruction or of death. Russian propaganda compares Ukrainians who are nationally conscious, who view themselves only as Ukrainians, who want to speak Ukrainian, who only want to partake in Ukrainian culture, those Ukrainians who reject Russian identity, who reject Russian language, who reject their participation in Russian culture, those Ukrainians are portrayed as Nazis. So when you have this operation where you're occupying a town, you're doing sweeps of different areas, and you're compiling lists of who the nationally conscious Ukrainians in that area are, and those are the ones that are slated for destruction or for imprisonment or for conditions that will make their life absolutely impossible, then it's really hard to interpret those acts as anything other than like a deliberate use of what is forbidden in the Genocide Convention as a weapon of war, basically.
Well, that's real World War II stuff. Taking the intellectuals or leaders of the town, making lists. Do you know? I mean, you said making lives miserable. I mean, are they actually executing people?
Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to make sure.
No, yeah, they so. Yes, the targeting of Ukrainians is like the. There are different things that Russia can do with a person who's been targeted. And that person also doesn't have to be on a list, right? Like Ukrainians report that, having Ukrainian national symbols, as tattoos can make you identifiable as somebody either for deportation or for destruction. There were reports that during the occupation of the Kyiv Oblast, Bucha, Irpin, Borodyanka, all of those places, that people were specifically targeted for having nationalist symbols tattooed onto them. And a nationalist symbol can be something as innocuous as the Ukrainian coat of arms or a Ukrainian word tattooed, or one really common tattoo in Ukraine right now is getting the letter Y, which is like an I with two dots on it, which is a letter that does not exist in the Russian alphabet, doesn't exist in the English alphabet, but exists in the Ukrainian alphabet. And so it's like a symbol of Ukrainian Ukraineness and Ukrainian like the uniqueness of Ukrainian identity and language and culture. And so this can manifest in being targeted for destruction. The biggest example or one of the bigger examples of this was during the occupation of Kherson. There was a really famous story of an orchestra conductor who the Russian government wanted to have a celebration concert to celebrate the annexation of Kherson. And they went to this guy's house, said, "You're going to conduct the concert." He said, "I'm a proud Ukrainian and I will not conduct your concert." I mean, I don't know that he said he was a proud Ukrainian, but he refused to conduct the concert. And then the military police came back and shot him, I believe, either the same day or the next day. This is something where, if they've determined that you are too nationalistic in their interpretation of what it means to be Ukrainian nationalist, you can be targeted for being summarily executed.
This is so Soviet. I just wanted to say that, Matthew. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's a good segue into kind of what I wanted to ask questions about, actually. You're a subject matter expert and historian of colonialism in Eastern Europe. And I think that a lot of times when people hear the word colonialism, they think, Belgium in the Congo. They think France and North Africa. They do not necessarily think of Eastern Europe. Like, that's part of the territories that's out and doing the colonizing, is it not? They might say. Yeah. Can you kind of give us the actual history there of, and I know that we've talked about this on the show before, but I think it's interesting and it's an important rubric to look through all of this stuff. Like, being caught between Germany and Russia is not a great place to be, right?
Yeah. So I think that's a really good thing to kind of wade into occasionally, because yes, you're right. Most people perceive colonialism as overseas expansion. You arrive in some foreign place with advanced weaponry, and you basically use your advanced military power to subjugate the people, and then you use that power to show them that you were dominant over them, dominate them for some time. And then at some point, you no longer need that military might in order to maintain your dominance, because you've colonized the people and they recognize that you are superior to them. And so the first thing that people have a hard time wrapping their heads around is that Ukraine is not overseas from Russia. It is on Russia's border. And similarly, right, like the way that Russia has acted towards Poland historically, Poles certainly feel like they're a post-colonial society. The Baltics also, a lot of people in Central Asia are starting to have that conversation. The way that one of the best ways to kind of answer this question is actually by kind of outlining how Russian colonialism in particular is different from Western colonialism. And I say Russian colonialism because, you know, other Eastern European nations and political projects have, you know, potentially engaged in some form of colonialism, depending on how broad we want to define that. And so I'm not saying that Russia is like necessarily completely unique, right? Like some Ukrainians would say that certain Polonization policies were a form of colonialism historically in Ukraine. But right now, if the main topic of the day is Russian colonialism, and so the way that Russian colonialism chiefly is differentiated from Western colonialism is, number one, there is no overseas aspect of it. It is largely just territorial expansion. But then another huge one is that Russian colonialism, because the Russians tried to colonize a lot of peoples, especially in Eastern Europe, who already had long European histories, this tactic of coming in with better weapons and dominating the society until the point where they recognize that you were superior to them, that doesn't work in Poland, and it doesn't work in Ukraine, because Poles look at that, like they look at Russian history and Russian culture, and they look at their own history and their own culture, and they're like, we're not like significantly different, and we like our literature better than we like your literature. We like our culture better than we like your culture. And no amount of guns or weapons are going to make you convince us of that. And this then creates a situation where Russia doesn't have an alternative to violence. Whereas a lot of South American, African, Asian countries have issues with navigating a post-colonial existence, where it's like, guys, like so the way that some post-colonial authors write is as if, like, you know, we should theoretically be free now. We need to chart our own course in some way. That doesn't necessarily apply in the same way that it does in these places, in these countries. But what also happens is that because some of the colonialism, particularly in Eastern Europe, is white people colonizing other white people, it creates a different problem that's not the same, which is, for example, in Ukraine, you had a lot of Ukrainians who realized, oh, I can just speak Russian, claim Russian identity, say that I'm not actually Ukrainian, and they'll leave me alone. But you are Ukrainian, you go home and you feel like Ukrainian, but you live your entire life basically internalizing all of these colonial narratives about yourself, and you have to regurgitate them to the urban elites that you're trying to appeal to in order to make sure that you are not bothered. And so this creates a lot of issues in Ukrainian societies that are in Ukrainian society that Ukrainian public intellectuals are very much debating right now. They were debating that for the entirety of Ukrainian independence, but that has become a really, really, really big topic in Ukraine right now. the topic of how do we navigate our like the Russian aspects of who we are. How do we separate ourselves from Russia culturally, linguistically? Do we like, why do so many Ukrainian political actors speak Russian at home? And do they need to? Should they stop? Is that just part of who they are? And so there's nothing we can do about it. How do we navigate these kinds of waters? And so it creates certain unique problems, but they are definitely distinct from that kind of Western colonialism that you were talking about.
And of course, Stalin was huge on moving populations from one place to another. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the Baltic nations, some of them still have very large Russian populations, and that's on purpose.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. This was, I mean, part of this. I mean, these Stalinist tactics, are ironically borrowed from the Russian Empire. The way that the Russian Empire tried to protect itself from the dying kind of heaves of the Russian Empire, try to protect itself from national awakenings around itself. The Soviet Union had a very obvious strategy that Putin is himself trying to recreate in Mariupol right now. It's something that they've been trying to do in Crimea. This idea of bringing in a bunch of ethnic Russians who then will always feel loyal to Russia. I lived in Donetsk in 2011, and I remember so many people saying, I'm Ukrainian, I feel Ukrainian, but my grandfather, my great grandfather is originally from Russia. And so I have something in me that is Russian and I can't let that go. And that's an intentional tactic. And the other thing is that oftentimes when we talk about, particularly we talk about Ukraine, we can also overlook what happened to Crimean Tatars and the way that, if you look at the population dynamics of Crimea from the 1800s to current day, there was a concerted effort to change the ethnic makeup of Crimea, to Russify it. And then during World War II, Stalin deported the Crimean Tatars, which the Crimean Tatars, view as their as a genocide that they also overcame. Right. So on the territory of Ukraine in that period between the two wars, so many peoples felt targeted by two different powers that were trying to colonize them. It's a discussion that finally is happening in a lot of places. And I can only hope that it keeps kind of getting bigger and bigger and bigger and more heard. And that we have more of these very serious conversations about re-examining why we view Russia the way that we do, because I feel like the answer to it is probably a lot of Russophilia around a lot of, academic and intellectual institutions in the West.
This also is a nice segue to one of the parts of the report that I found really fascinating is how naked a lot of the rhetoric is from Russian leadership and in Russian media. Can you explain the phrase, "we can do it again"?
Yeah, so that phrase goes back apparently to the 1940s, and it basically means we can show our power, we can dominate again, and it apparently references the domination or the victory over Germany. Like we can make this happen again. I'm really happy that we use that as kind of the anchor of how we explored the historical context of the current day invasion, because it also kind of illustrates the way that World War II historical memory has become weaponized, because now it's less about we overcame a particular evil, and it's more about which And I should say that We Overcame a Particular Evil was a far more ingrained memory in the West than it ever was in Russia. In Russia, a lot of the historical memory around World War II has been the great Russian people overcame like a great invasion. But this has been, this has become bastardized so much to the point that, you know, the victory in World War II now just means anyone who F's with Russia will suffer the wrath of Russia. And so this means that, actually, this reminds me of a story from, I lived in Moscow, and I, when the first invasion in 2014 happened, I was in Moscow, and I was curious what was happening in opposition politics. So I was actually at a, I was at a petition drive where a candidate for local, for like the local city council of Moscow, was trying to get signatures on a petition in order to get his name on the ballot. And they were just walking up to people who lived in that district who were like, hey, you know, we know that you might not vote for him, but we think that, you know, the people of Moscow deserve a choice on who they should elect to their city council. They, you know, they gave this guy's pitch. His pitch was that United Russia is corrupt, that he was an infrastructure expert, particularly on traffic, how to relieve traffic problems in Moscow. And so he was like, they're corrupt. And so the traffic problems, that's due to United Russia corruption. And this old woman, I remember distinctly, looks at the person trying to get her signature and says, I wouldn't criticize United Russia because Putin is doing so much to prevent Ukrainian Nazis from coming to Moscow. And they say, well, we understand that, but will you at least consider signing your name so that his name is on the ballot, even if you're going to vote against him? And the woman says, okay, I'll sign my name because I believe in democracy and I believe that that we should have a choice. What is the guy's name? And the person says, Maxim Katz. And she goes, oh, I'm not signing anything for a Jew. And that to me is like the perfect encapsulation of the tension with Russian historical memory. The defeat of the Nazis was not overcoming a unique evil that targeted Jews in particular for destruction, along with other groups. The problem with the Nazis was that the Nazis tried to invade Russia, or tried to invade what Russia views as its own historical territory. And that is ultimately the problem. And so coming back to this phrase, we can do it again, right? The phrase basically means, like, it's used as a jingoistic rhetorical device to remind Russians, or for Russians to remind themselves and to try to remind the rest of the world that we can destroy you again. We can overcome anything that you throw at us. And it reminds me of, you know, when you're in Russia around May 9th, there's always people have like stickers on their cars that say like on to Berlin. Right. Like as it started off as a tongue in cheek thing. And now it's not so tongue in cheek anymore. It's like, we're going to eventually like dominate Europe again. And so, yeah, this kind of this phrase, I think, really underscores the kind of bastardization of that historical memory and how it's being weaponized to justify genocide in Ukraine.
And can you tell me about the 60 Minutes interview? It's Russian 60 Minutes, to be clear. That is talked about kind of alongside We Can Do It Again, and the way the military leaders talk about Ukraine and how that strengthens the case that genocide is occurring.
Yeah, so I would. So my argument would be that in terms of how strong the case of Russia violating the Genocide Convention is, I would say that. That number one, Russia is absolutely in violation of the Genocide Convention. I mean, I'm convinced that they're in violation on several articles. But if I had to pick one that I could prove 100% beyond a reasonable doubt that anyone could ever possibly have, and I know for sure that there is like it's an absolute slam dunk, I have all of the evidence that I need in the open, that would be incitement to genocide. So the Genocide Convention does not only prohibit the act of genocide. It also prohibits several other acts, one of which is incitement to genocide. And so our report last year, what we found We did not officially find that Russia was committing genocide in Ukraine. Many of the authors, including myself, thought that Russia was committing genocide in Ukraine. But in terms of making a legal argument, we felt most comfortable saying that Russia was in violation of incitement to genocide and that there was a serious risk of genocide, because functionally speaking, there is no legal difference in terms of what to do next, because the next step is that countries have a duty to prevent genocide. So going back to the question, this is kind of the easiest, most obvious case to make. It's not even like the quotes that we included in the report are just ones that we particularly found as powerful. They are not all encompassing. They are not all inclusive. I forget the website.
It's almost as if you have too much material to work with.
Yeah, it's so much. It was part of the problem. So this updated report, to give you a little bit of an insight, is like 50 to 60 pages, somewhere in there. It was supposed to be short. It was supposed to be just a very short summary of how dynamics have shifted. And it became a challenge of citing specific examples to be like, yes, these things are really happening. But then not citing every single example that you come across, which means now you have to weigh the significance of citing one thing over the other. But there is, there is one absolutely amazing resource that I will direct everybody to take a look at, which is Just Security has an updating list that they've titled, if you just Google Russia's Eliminationist Rhetoric Against Ukraine, a collection by Clara Apt. It is an absolutely brilliant, it's a living, breathing document that is updated regularly with different eliminationist rhetoric about Ukrainians. There are other quotes that are just fascinating. So what we try to capture in the report is that the Russian narratives continually shift. So when the full-scale invasion started, the push from the propaganda machine was that Ukrainians are all Nazis, or at least not all Ukrainians are all Nazis. We're just going to go into Ukraine, special military operation. We're going to cut out the Nazis. In one of the quotes, somebody says that it's like cutting out a tumor, and you have to go in with precision. But then it kind of starts shifting, and you start around, late March into April, around the time we find out about Bucha, you start to hear a lot of concern from Russian propagandists that actually, oh my God, there are so many Ukrainians that are Nazis. And then it becomes this problem where actually Russia has lost an entire generation of young Ukrainians who are all deep down Nazis, and we have to do something about it, which is particularly concerning when you combine that with the forced deportations of Ukrainian children. You combine that with the camps that they're sent to, with the crimes committed against children in those camps. But then you see this shift to it's not just they're Nazis or they have this Nazi ideology. It's that they're demonic. Like they are literally possessed by Satan and you start to have these religious undertones of you have to prove to us that you're not demonic or we're going to destroy you.
I have, I've got both quotes pulled up here. I'll read them. So the 60 Minutes interview, this is with a Duma deputy. Quote, a maximum of five, and this is 2022, a maximum of 5% are incurable. Simply put, 2 million people, these 2 million people should have left Ukraine or must be denazified, which means to be destroyed. And then the next bit is from a military figure. Quote, Russian people possessed by the devil But if you, but if Ukrainians don't want us to change your minds, then we will kill you. We will kill as many of you as we have to. We will kill 1 million or 5 million. We can exterminate all of you until you understand that you are possessed and have to be cured.
Yeah, and those run in parallel with, there's another quote from Margarita Simonyan, who is the director of like RT. She's like a really, she's a very, very prominent figure in the Russian nationalist space. And she, at one point in, like a couple months into the war, made a comment about, I thought it wasn't that many, but there are so many who have just been possessed by this Nazi frenzy. And of course, yes, yeah, like they're very open about this. And that, that second quote that you read, that was from, actually, one of the, he was literally the first collaborator. He was, a guy who declared himself like the people's mayor of Donetsk, or the people's governor of Donetsk. I forget which one, Pavel Gubarov. And he is, his background is like, yeah, he's like, he's a Russian nationalist who was involved in like a Russian, far right, organization, you know, when he was younger. And yeah, like, this idea that Ukrainians are Russians who have been, convinced by the West to reject their own Russianness. And that in order to, solve the problems of, in order to save Ukraine and to save Ukrainians in their minds, they have to destroy all of the Ukrainians who are not, who think of themselves this way and refuse to change. And actually, I also want to point that, these quotes also, help support the argument by a very prominent international lawyer named Wayne Jordash, who is working with the Reckoning Project, in Ukraine right now. And he's also working on the topic of genocide. And what he says, he spoke at a book festival, in June. And one of his points that he made was, so by Putin's own admission, or by Russia's own admission, by the way that we understand Russia, and their goals for the invasion, they thought that they were going to come into Ukraine and that the vast majority of Ukrainian society was going to welcome them with open arms. And that they only had to resolve like problems with a little bit of Ukrainian society, you know, that like, you know, 80% would welcome Russia with open arms. And that's what they were expecting when they first rolled in. That's why they had such a problem, you know, getting to Kyiv, is they didn't think that they would have a serious fight on the way there. The problem then becomes, okay, so then what was their plan with the other 20%? Like, what was the plan with the people who weren't going to welcome them? What did they expect to do? And what they have shown us, in the subsequent occupation of regions, they've shown us what they were planning to do with that other 20% that they, the problem that Russia faces is they didn't realize that Ukrainians actually believe that they're Ukrainian. They didn't realize that the percentage of people who are willing to reject their own Ukrainian identity is significantly smaller than what they thought, even in Russian speaking parts of Ukraine. And that has become a very, very, very big challenge that, you know, manifests itself in the way that Russia operates in occupied areas.
All right, Angry Planet listeners, we're going to pause there for a break. We'll be right back after this.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
All right, Angry Planet listeners, welcome back. We are on with Christopher Atwood. Can you, I know that we've talked about it before, but I just want to make it explicitly clear. Can you then talk about the way that Russia operates in those occupied areas?
Yeah, sure. So, one of the most disturbing parts of, I mean, the whole report obviously is very disturbing. And the way that children are targeted is incredibly disturbing. But one of the hardest things to read and to kind of work on was it's Russia's violations of Article 2D of the Genocide Convention, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. So when Russia occupies an area, they make sweeps of the different like residential areas, and they will like, so this goes deeper than just making lists. They will find women and they will target those women for sexual assault. And there have actually been instances where women have testified that, so for example, I pulled one of the quotes up. There was a woman who was beaten for 10 days during the occupation of Izum. And when she was initially detained, Russian soldiers told her, "We'll beat the Ukrainian out of you." Another woman was held in a basement for 25 days and was told that they were going to rape her until she didn't want any sexual contact with any men so that she wouldn't have Ukrainian children. So basically, when the Russian occupation authorities take over your town, you are at their entire mercy. I've heard, so obviously, while compiling this report, we have to read through a bunch of stuff and then identify what specifically points to violations of the Genocide Convention. But, you know, you end up coming across a lot of things. And like, you know, some of the things are just like they will see a young man and then they will go and talk to other people and then say that somebody says something that like makes the Russian authorities think that that young man that they saw three houses ago is potentially a Ukrainian nationalist. Like they will go back and they'll arrest him. Or if they find out that somebody had, just signed up for the territorial defenses, then they will go back and they will arrest them. They will go to orphanages and ask where the children are so that they can take them away from the town. In international law, there are certain like protections there are certain measures that you're supposed to take when you're trying to protect the civilian population. So, for example, if you want to transfer populations in an occupied area, you're supposed to transfer them to a third party country, not to your country. If you're occupying new territory. Now there are certain like you can get around that. Like if there's a medical emergency, and you know the nearest hospital is in Russian territory, then technically speaking, Russia would be in Russia would be allowed to like take a Ukrainian child to a Russian hospital to get that Ukrainian child like emergency medical care. And so they will use that excuse, for example, as well. Another really big thing that you hear a lot of is they've entered your town. They've done all the sweeps. They've, you know, filtered out who they think they need to filter out. They've got the list of people to monitor. So they will now they'll start badgering the local media in that area. A lot of the time, the local media has already fled because they know that they're going to potentially be targeted. Or they will take over the editorial staffs of these publications, and they'll just start publishing from that media organization's name and claim that now they're suddenly pro-Russian. And then you'll also hear cases of they will start pressuring parents and say, "Hey, you know, this is a really stressful time right now, especially for your kids. You know that we have a free camp program where you can send your kids to vacation in Crimea or in South Russia or somewhere, and they'll be totally safe. And once we've stabilized the situation on the front lines, once we've pushed the front lines more into the other direction, you know, your kids will come back and they'll be refreshed and they'll be happy. And then those kids get sent off. The parents don't have any way to contact the camps that the kids were sent to. Sometimes the parents will eventually get the camp person's phone number. And then you will hear horror stories. For example, after Ukraine liberated the Kharkiv Oblast, parents who had sent their kids to camps from the Kharkiv Oblast were basically told, we're not going to give you your kids back because you're under Ukrainian control now, and we don't trust that. And they will tell the kids themselves, they'll tell the kids, like, you're not going home until we take back your hometown. And it's just this, it's this like never ending hell. And this is like, this is from reading reports, but I've also, I've spoken to people who have, you know, lived in these conditions, who have relatives who live in the conditions, and it's way easier for me, I recognize, to just kind of like outline these things and kind of like highlight the things that I think are the most the most like important to like highlight in a short conversation. But you know, it really is like just 24/7 hell. And it's just like constant stress. You have loved ones who are on, you know, Ukrainian government controlled territory, and you don't know how long you're going to be able to be in contact with them. You don't know how you're going to actually have a, you know if you're ever going to see them again. You don't know if you can actually cross back into Ukraine again. There's actually a really, really amazing film that I highly recommend that is currently, it just was had its theatrical release in the US. And then in the future, I believe that it will be more widely distributed because it's the distribution is run by PBS. So I'm pretty sure that it's going to be very widely distributed. It's a movie called 20 Days in Mariupol that follows the first 20 days of the full scale invasion through the eyes of a couple of AP journalists. And basically they documented the first 20 days of the, you know, of the invasion from Mariupol. And that film, I will say, it's such a brilliant, it's so well documented. The director understood what was happening and that he was living in a historical moment. And so he started documenting literally everything that was around him. And I will tell you, watching that film after having worked on the two, genocide reports, like it lines up one to one with how it kind of like, with how how it reads and how these conversations make me feel, like seeing the images on the screen, like 100% line up to what I kind of, you know, envision this feels like. And the other testimony that I've heard from other people who have lived under these conditions.
So this is from the top. I just want to make clear, like, the culpability here, because we've really talked, you know, about, you know, spokespeople, other people are on TV and, you know, and you also already said that, well, what about that 20% of, you know, Ukrainians who can't be converted back to Russians? Yeah. Was this genocide planned ahead of time? I guess that's my question.
So that is, I'm glad you asked that question, because that question is the kind of question that genocide scholars and international human rights lawyers are having amongst themselves right now. That is kind of the big question. That is the question that is kind of like, that is kind of like one of the forbidden topics at dinner, because it turns into a very long, debate, because, there's, you know, there's arguments on both sides, right? The argument on the, you know, genocide was pre-planned side says that, well, you know, we know what Russia's plan was when they occupied areas, because we've seen what happened when they occupied areas. And so, you know, like, they knew this going in. But then there's also the other argument that says basically, they didn't plan to carry out genocide because they didn't think they were going to need to carry out genocide. And they basically created the conditions where genocide would necessarily have to happen if there was the kind of resistance that they experienced. And that, to me personally, feels like a slightly more plausible explanation, although both of them to me are like, I feel like the distinction between the two, it has implications in like legal theory, as far as I understand, but I don't know all of the nuance of those implications because I don't have a law background. But to me, it feels like Russia genuinely bought into these propaganda narratives that they are living by, and that they really thought that they would just come in. They'd overwhelmingly, there'd be overwhelming support for the Russian army, and then you would just magically have Russian Ukraine again. And you wouldn't need to do anything with the people. But the problem is that they necessarily created the conditions under which genocide would have to happen if there's any amount of resistance whatsoever among the civilian population, right? When you're telling your so an important aspect of last year's report, that was like a huge, huge, huge red flag was a journalist at the New York Times noticed that the Russian army has to consume 1 hour per day of Russian state media. When you look at what the actual Russian the military schedule says, it says like in Russian, it says like informational programming, right? Which means state propaganda, like state run news. So Kremlin propaganda. So Russian soldiers every day are watching 1 hour of propaganda that was dominated and still is dominated by what are effectively these genocidal narratives about Ukrainians, right? Like when Russian soldiers are hearing that Ukrainians who are obsessed with speaking Ukrainian and who refuse to speak Russian are Nazis, that Ukrainians who that actually there's a lot more Nazis than we initially thought, and that Ukrainian identity is effectively interchangeable with being a nationalist, and being a nationalist is effectively interchangeable with being a Nazi. And then you send that person to Bucha and you tell them to occupy Bucha. And then it turns out that the people in Bucha don't want to be occupied by the Russian army. And then you're given the orders that you should shoot the civilian population if it's necessary. Right. Like you're creating the conditions. You're necessarily creating those conditions, whether or not those conditions are being created. From before the war started, because they predicted that this would happen. I don't know whether that's like ultimately the ultimate relevant thing to highlight. But rather the fact that you created these conditions, and that these conditions created a foreseeable result. Like it's obvious what's going to happen when you send men with guns into a town and tell them that their job is to denazify the town and that they can shoot civilians. Like it's you know what you're doing in that circumstance. So I think that ultimately I don't have an answer. I think that probably they didn't think that they were going to need to carry out genocide, but I also don't think that they saw genocide as a problem. Like that if it came to eliminating the Ukrainian national identity, nobody at the top has a problem with like physically liquidating ethnic Ukrainians, like or national, like members of the Ukrainian national group, right? Like nobody at the top has a problem with that. They're completely fine with it. You see rhetoric like that, right? You know, in the report on Russian national news, but you also see it like in Eurasianist political ideology, right? Like the things that Dugin writes and the things that people like him support, right? Like even like like there's the whole thing with Igor Girkin Strelkov, who was arrested recently. There was a big uproar online that he was portrayed as just like an opposition figure, when actually his problem with the way that Putin is carrying out the war is that he's not carrying out the war brutally enough. Whereas someone like Yevgeny Prigozhin is upset that he can't just destroy everything in sight, regardless of whether or not it's good or bad or something that should be destroyed or not be destroyed. Prigozhin thinks we should be using more violence to win all of these battles. Prigozhin does not seem like he is super ideologically interested in the destruction of the Ukrainian national group. Whereas Igor Girkin, like, that's his whole thing. Like, that's his whole thing is like restoring this like Russian imperial order. And like, he does, like, his issue with the way that Putin is carrying out the war is that it's not effective enough in destroying the Ukrainian national identity. So like, there's certainly an appetite for the destruction of the Ukrainian national group, and that appetite has always existed. So whether or not they went into the war intending to carry out a genocide of Ukrainians, I think ultimately isn't the final barometer, but rather that they were always okay with this outcome and that they created the conditions where this outcome wouldn't be necessary. Like, it would necessarily be the case if they encountered any kind of resistance, and they encountered even more resistance probably than they expected.
I don't want to get lost in a Strelkov related tangent, but I do want to note that I thought it was fucked up when he was arrested that all of the headlines said Putin critic and not convicted war criminal. Or any of the other things that can be attributed to him.
Let me also say that his arrest and the whole situation with Prigozhin kind of pointed out that one of the things that Western intellectuals fall into the trap of is they get very caught up in the idea of a dissident, somebody who also rejects Putin. And this is also something that the Russian opposition gets very caught up in. So you saw Navalny publicly voicing support for Strelkov Girkin. You also heard people in Navalny's camp say, like, we need to support Prigozhin because he is like the best resistance against Putin at the moment when the, you know, march on Moscow was happening. And, you know, you realize that, you know, being especially when you're kind of this deep in understanding things, that, you know, resisting Putin himself creates a lot of very odd bedfellows. And we really have to be very careful not to get caught up in who is a dissident and who is you know, like, just like being like, well, he technically is a dissident because he was criticizing Putin and then Putin arrested him. Well, yeah, but why was he criticizing Putin?
I just want to make sort of a statement, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that we have this really stupid idea in the general, you know, Western civilization that we were beyond this. That, you know, white Europeans are beyond this. And in, you know, the United States, I think, tries to throw itself into the same bag. You know, we're certainly beyond this. And it just shows, man, that, I mean, human nature and, I mean, the demons of the past have not been exorcised, right? I mean, we are still living with the fact that we are human. And humanity has this possible turn of just sucking.
I mean, I think that it goes really, really deep. And I think that part of the problem that I see is that we always want very, very simple answers to very, very, very complex problems. And what we're seeing in Russia, and the way that Russia is carrying out this war is it's top down, no doubt about that. This is Putin's vision for creating his own legacy and for, restoring whatever revanchist ideas he has for the Russian Empire. But at the same time, this is only possible because there are certain narratives that exist culturally in Russia that have existed for a very long time that have never been confronted within Russian society. And these narratives are obviously very terrifying, but you know, the way that Ukrainians are dehumanized in Russian culture is not a unique phenomenon in the world. A lot of groups of people who are either protected by the Genocide Convention or even groups of people who are not protected by the Genocide Convention suffer from a similar dehumanization. At the current moment, there aren't as many governments who are willing to carry out the kind of destructive violence that Putin, one, has the capacity to carry out, but then two, has like the desire to actually fully go through with it. But I don't think that that's, you know, that's not going to be always the case historically. It's not going to be the case that, you know, in Europe, there's just this one case where one dictator has, you know, made it his vision to, you know, to leverage this twisted idea of Ukrainians in order to carry out this kind of a genocidal war. There are other groups who are also vulnerable, and all it takes is somebody with the power to weaponize similar narratives about other peoples, and we could be facing the same thing, you know, in other contexts. And, you know, to a degree, you know, in other contexts, things are happening around the world that we should also be very concerned about and recognize as similar kinds of violence. But yeah, no, this is not... we are not past this. I agree.
What should the response from the international community be then?
I think I appreciated last year there was a hearing held by the Helsinki Commission in Congress on the topic of genocide in Ukraine. And I really, really, really liked Timothy Snyder's answer to this question. Basically, Tim Snyder said, we are in a very unique position in terms of a genocide. There has never been this kind of an opportunity where the victims of a genocide literally have a trustworthy state apparatus that can be supported. Every country in the world has a duty to prevent genocide. And so that means that that's a sliding scale, by the way. So that means that, like, if you are very close to Russia, you have more of a responsibility to use your relations with Russia to leverage them into not committing genocide. But if we can provide Ukraine with the tools that it needs to prevent genocide on its own soil, then we have not only a moral duty, but a legal duty to ensure that. Basically, the only thing that the international courts prohibit in terms of responding to genocide is you can't unilaterally enter a conflict to prevent a genocide. So like Russia is invading Ukraine also under the pretext of preventing genocide, right? Like one of the things in the lead up to the full scale invasion was Ukraine is committing genocide against Russians in Donbass. So we have to go there to save the Russians. So the courts generally seem to frown on using military intervention to prevent genocide, but nothing stops the international community from making sure that Ukraine has everything that it needs to prevent genocide. So that means, from where I'm standing, that means providing Ukraine with every weapon that it needs. It means providing Ukraine with more artillery. It means providing Ukraine with more training, with air defense. It means using more sanctions against Russia. It means, you know, considering even more measures against Russia. We still haven't. The State Department is terrified of designating Russia a state sponsor of terrorism because they've never attempted to suspend another country's sovereign immunity that was that large. And so they're very, very, very terrified of that step. But if Russia is designated a state sponsor of terrorism, then also Russia like is a place where companies can't do business, which means that all of the huge corporations that have calculated that it's actually financially more viable to continue supporting genocidal war by continuing to do business in that country, those companies will no longer be able to make the determination that it's economically viable, because now you will be in violation of U.S. sanctions. So I think that increasing measures like that, I think that we cannot forget that when we're talking about genocide, we're talking about people view it as the crime of crimes, right? And so there should not be a measure that is too far when we're talking about the kinds of crimes that Russia is committing. It should be basically isolating Russia from the international community and rallying around Ukraine to ensure that Ukraine has everything that it needs to win the war.
Christopher Atwood, thank you so much for coming on to Angry Planet and walking us through this.
Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
That's all for this week, Angry Planet listeners. As always, Angry Planet is me, Matthew Galt, Jason Fields, and Kevin O'Dell. It's created by myself and Jason Fields. If you like us, if you really like us, please go to angryplanetpod.com or angryplanet.substack.com. Kick us $9 a month. It helps us produce the show. It keeps us going. You get early versions of the mainline episodes that are commercial-free. You also get bonus episodes, some other stuff that I'm working on that's coming down the pipe. Share more about that with you when it's a little bit closer to being ready. Kevin's on a reporting trip right now. I think we're going to have him on the show when he gets back from that. I don't want to spoil what it's about, but he's witnessing a pretty important news story. Excited to have him on. Next week, we're going to have somebody come on, talk to us about what's going on in Africa. It's a pretty important story. We're generally going to drill down on why we should be paying more attention to that continent, especially in the West, kind of what it means and what's happening. So, we will be back next week with another conversation about conflict on an angry planet. Stay safe until then.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.